What's up, Herm? Woo! Man, you guys are pumped today, huh? You guys are nuts. All right. Awesome. I love you too. Welcome. You guys are so nuts. You threw me off. I'm done. I'll see you guys next week. We are in a new series that's called One Another, and we're going to be, the scripture, if you don't know this, talks about all kinds of one another's, different things that we need to think about when we think about each other. And so we're going to go through some of those one another's over the next month. But I do want to just reiterate, I know Dean talked about connection groups when he was up here. I do just want to reiterate how important they are. And as a church grows, it really is hard to get to know each other. And this is an opportunity for us to get out of rows and get into circles with each other. And so if you don't know, you can sign up all September. So we don't expect you to figure that out today, but just know they're out there and you can start to think about what works for you. But what we're going to do is from October to December is what you're actually signing up for. So the groups will only last for a few months and then they'll break and then you'll have an opportunity to sign up again if you want to. But there's an in and an out for you. We think that's really important for people. And not only that, but the sermon, all of the groups are going to be taking what is preached on that week, the scriptures, the ideas, the topics, and you'll be able to delve into those a little bit deeper. And I found in my own life, with my own group, even though I write these sermons, I have seen huge fruit reaped out of talking about these topics and scriptures with other people and letting it really marinate in my life, not just for one Sunday, but for the whole week. And so that's my little pitch. I hope you guys will really sign up for those. Just check them out today and kind of look at what we've got going on out there. You can ask questions, all that kind of stuff. Let me pray, and then we will jump into the sermon. And as Dean told you, I think I'm like 90% better, but if my voice starts to sound like it's like losing or something, I'm kind of coming off the end of a cold or something. So anyway, let me just pray and then we'll start. Father, I thank you for this church, how fun they are. And God, I don't know that I've been in a place that has this kind of life in it before. And I thank you for that. I pray that you would protect and guard that life and that we would all be bearers of that in our everyday interactions with one another's. That God, as we seek to just be more like you, that Jesus, you would do a real work in us. I pray today, just like always, that you would get me out of the way and let your word shine, that the cross would come into full focus for us today. I love you, Jesus. It's in your name that I pray. Amen. So the other day, I did something kind of unusual. I got on Google Maps, and I started looking just at the hometown that I grew up in until eighth grade. So this was Topeka, Kansas. You may have heard of Topeka because you had to learn the capitals of the United States, and that was the capital of Kansas. I lived there, grew up there, and I decided to do something that like 10 or 15 years ago you couldn't do. I got on Google Maps, and I street viewed it, and I went to my home. Have you ever does anybody love to like go past your childhood home and reminisce and think about, oh, I remember this, and that was my bedroom? I remembered that there's a room in there that the closet has a big K scratched into the door on the inside. And the good news is my little sister's name is Katie. And so when she got that room and I moved out of it, my parents finally found the big K on the door and they were like, who did this? And Katie was like 3 and I was like, must have been Katie. I don't know. Like, why would I scratch a giant K on a door? She got in big trouble. I am a turd. I know it. I remembered things like I loved snow, and I still love snow, and this story will tell you a lot about my personality. It had snowed like crazy, and I woke up the next morning, I think I was like 2 or 3. Like, this memory is really vivid, but I was really little, because I came out, I'm just in my underwear or whatever I'm wearing, and I see all the snow, and I just bust through the door, throw it open, and I jump like flying squirrel into the snow. I just like, whoop, and I land in it, and I was like, ah! And then I was like, ah! Because it was freezing cold, you know? My mom came running out and picked me up and took me inside. I remembered, as I was looking at that, I remembered laying on the porch when it rained and listening to the raindrops hit. And I remembered my mom made the Superman outfit for me, and because my name was Kent and Superman's last name was Kent, I was like, I'm probably Superman. And so I would go out on the sidewalk and I would run as fast as I could and go and try to fly, and it never once worked. I don't know why, but it never did. Like, all of those memories came flooding back into my head as I looked at this house that I grew up in, this little one-car garage, tiny little know-nothing house. And then other memories started to flood. I started to remember things like, we were really, really poor there. We didn't have air conditioning. I didn't have air conditioning growing up. We didn't have cable. To me, cable was something rich people had. I told this to the first service. If I was at a friend's house and they'd be like, hey, do you want something to drink? We got like water, Sprite, we've got milk. I would never take the milk because in my family, you only used milk for cooking. People who could drink milk, they were rich people, right? Like, it was like liquid gold if you had milk. And you, to this day, still, if my kids drink a cup of milk and they leave half of it, I take it and I put it in the fridge. And I'm like, we're not wasting that milk. We're saving it till the end. Cause I've just made my son Simon drink his milk from like 3 days ago. Like, probably disgusting. It's been sitting in the fridge, but it's ingrained inside of me that all I remember. I remember the church that we occasionally went to had a clothing little pantry, and it was literally a box in the basement of the church. And I remember going with my family because we were too poor to buy clothes for school, and we had to dig through this box while the guy who kind of ran the pantry stood there with his keys watching us. And we had to dig out clothes that we were going to wear for school that year. Like, I remember all of that stuff. And I have to tell you, it really has influenced who I am as an adult. Because if I've learned something, that when you remember what you've gone through, like really remembering what you've gone through can shape what you go through if you'll let it, right? If you'll let it, if you won't forget it, if you'll go through stuff and you won't forget all the lessons that you learned from going through it, it can shape, and sometimes in positive ways, and some of you know, like me forcing my son to drink 3-day-old milk that's just slowly been evaporated in the fridge, maybe not the most positive, but it will shape who you are if you'll let it, if you don't forget those things, if you keep them around with you and you walk through, the things that you've gone through can actually make a difference. This morning, I want to take you into a passage in Matthew chapter 18 of a guy who very quickly forgot what he had gone through. And so if you guys would, open up your Bibles to Matthew 18. If you don't have a Bible, you can pull it up on your phone. Just don't, you know, get on Facebook or be texting somebody. But you can open up your phone. I would encourage you, if you do not have the YouVersion Bible app, you should download that app. It's fantastic. It's free. And it's a way to take the scripture with you everywhere you go. So Matthew 18, and we're going to jump into the middle of Jesus telling this story about this forgetful guy. All right, here we go. It's Matthew 18, 23 through 35. Therefore, he says, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. As he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 bags of gold was brought to him. So you get the picture, right? This king, he's wealthy. He's got everything. Like, he's a king. He lives in opulence. He sits down with his books, his bookkeeper, whatever. Maybe somebody said to him, hey, you've got a ton of outstanding debts that are owed to you. I don't know how it happened, but he realizes he needs to start accounting for all this debt. And he brings this guy in, and the guy comes in, and I don't know what he looked like. I picture him being a little sheepish because he owes 10,000 bags of gold. Now, I know that's kind of meaningless for you because none of us lived during the gold rush era, right? Maybe a few of you, most of us didn't, right? Like, none of us know how much gold is worth. And actually, the NIV is translating, they're interpreting a Greek word here because the actual Greek word is talents. And so, in Greek, it says there were 10,000 talents. But that's still meaningless to us, right? Until you know that a talent was worth 20 years of wages. Imagine for a moment, take your wages and multiply for a year and multiply that by 20. Now this is probably 20 years of wages at minimum wage kind of level of living, but still. I actually sat down to do some math on this, and then I remembered that I'm a pastor and I am not good at math. And so I found a guy through the miracles of Google who is good at math, and he had done the math on all this. So let me take you through the math from this guy. 10,000 talents. It's 200,000 years of labor at minimum wage. 200,000 years worth of money this guy has, he's just blown somehow. It is the equivalent of 60 million working days. How many of you just love a good day's work? Not 60 million years worth, all right? Or 60 million days worth. It is the modern equivalent of $3.48 billion that this guy has lost. Yeah, some of you are like, I feel good about my $26,000 I owe on my minivan still, right? Like, you, all of a sudden it makes everything feel better for you. I'm not that bad off into debt. This guy, $3.5 million in debt. And you know what's gonna happen, right? The guy comes in and this is what, listen to what it says. Since he was not able to pay. I mean, this is the amount of money, and Jesus' listeners in his day would have known immediately that said, you can't pay that amount of money back. There's nobody. He could work to his bones every single day for the rest of his life, and there's no way he would ever be able to pay that back. Since he was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. Now, I know for you, this feels like something far off, but for these people in this time, this was something that could actually happen to them. This is not like, I can't even imagine. This is like, I can't imagine because my uncle had this happen to his family. He couldn't pay the debt. He got sold off into servitude. I want you for a moment to take yourself out of this. I live in this world that's pretty easy, and if I have debt, I just declare bankruptcy and nobody even cares anymore. I don't want people to know. It's a little embarrassing, but this is like how things were handled then. So he's going to have to go home and tell his wife, honey, I know you didn't know. I've made some really bad business deals. I bet on AOL. And it did not pan out, right? I mean, like, he's going to have to go home and explain that he bet the farm and he lost the farm. Sell my wife, sell my children, all that he had sold to repay the debt. At this, the servant fell on his knees before him. Be patient with me, he begged, and I will pay back everything. This is his only option at this point. His only option is to get on his knees and beg for forgiveness. Beg that this king will just let him go. Please, please let me go. But you know the story, right? The king is going to grab him by the throat. Isn't this what you would do? He's going to grab him by the throat and shove him up against the wall and say, I forgive your debt? No, you owe me. You owe me your life. You owe me your wife. You owe me your children. I forgive nothing. I mean, at least that's the way I think it could go. Let's read in verse 27 and see what actually happened. Some of you are like, man, Kent, you don't sound sick. Here we go. Verse 27. The servant's master took pity on him. Pity, it's one of those words that you don't want people to use with you, right? Don't pity me. Or you might say, I pity the fool, right? Like, but we don't like to be pitied, but in this moment, if you were to have any kind of pity and you were in that moment, you would take it, right? He pities him. He has pity on him and he looks at him and he says, oh, the servant's master took pity on him. And what does he do? He canceled the debt and let him go. What do you do if that's you? Cancel the debt, $3.5 billion. Are you sure? Did I hear you right? Yeah. You know what? The debt's canceled. I'm not going to hold you to it. There's no way you could ever pay it. You're forgiven of it. Sir, are you sure? If it's me, I don't know about you, but if it's me, I can't do it. But I'd be like doing that thing, you know? Like, don't laugh at me. Just come. I'd be running around like dancing a jig and like kicking my leg. I'd be like singing a song. Like it would turn into a musical all of a sudden, right? This is what I would do. But I want you to listen to what the guy does. Are you ready for this? Verse 28. But when that servant went out, right? When he went out dancing. He went out and he bought everybody some champagne. Let's celebrate. That's not what he did. Look what he did. He found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 silver coins. He went out and he found. Now, it could be that he just stumbled upon this person. I have a sneaky suspicion that this guy, because of the amount of debt he owed, and he walked away probably in his mind, because if you're like me, you still feel this guilt, like, I should have paid. I've seen so many Christians who have done this in their own faith, like, I should be better. I shouldn't have needed Jesus to die for me. That kind of thing. And he walks out, and what does he do? He finds somebody who owes him money. How much did he owe him? 100 silver coins. Actually, the Greek again here is denarii. It's not talents. How much is a denarii? I found somebody else who could do the math on this, so let's put it up there. 1 denarii equals 1 day's labor. So at minimum wage, which I know minimum wage has all of a sudden gone up to $15 without anybody changing legislation on it. How many the rest of you, anybody in here like thinking, I might get a second job at Sonic or McDonald's, $15 an hour, I can flip burgers, I love flipping a burger. You're like, $72.50 for one denarii. Minimum wage. 100 denarii, what this guy owes? $725. That's what he owes. He owes this guy who owed billions of dollars. He owes him $725. Even if he still had to pay back the billions, the $725 would be meaningless, right? It would be literally not even a molecule in a drop of water in that bucket. It would be nothing. But look at what he does. He grabbed him and began to choke him. I knew I remembered that from the story somewhere. He grabbed him and he began to choke him. Pay back what you owe me, he demanded. His fellow servant fell to his knees and begged him, be patient with me and I will pay it back. Do you remember those words being said earlier? I'm surprised that this guy, it doesn't pop into his mind the memory of him standing in front of the king himself saying, be patient with me, I'll pay it back, on his knees begging. But it doesn't. Verse 30, but he refused. Instead, he went off and had the man thrown into prison until he could pay the debt. He takes this guy who owes him $725, not even $1,000, like he literally probably could pay it off if he was just given the time. And what does he do to him? He grabs him, and it doesn't say that he throws him, but don't you picture him almost like throwing him up against the building or something? I picture this all taking place in a dark alley. I don't know if it did, but that's right. And he grabs him by the throat and he's choking him. And he's saying, you pay me back now! You pay me back every cent! And what does this guy do? He falls on his knees, please, please. He won't listen to him. He throws him in jail. Can I just ask you a question? What do you do with someone like that? What do you do with someone who cannot remember where they came from? Who can't remember, like, he literally just came out of this moment of absolute, complete, utter forgiveness in a way that nobody could have imagined. And then in the very next moment, he's trying to hold hostage this other guy for quite a little sum. What do you do with someone like that? Let me tell you what the master, the king, does. Verse 31, when the other servants saw what had happened, they were outraged. They went and told their master everything that had happened. Then the master called the servant in. You wicked servant. I canceled all that debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you? In anger, his master handed him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should pay back all that he owed. This to me is a terrifying scene. But I'll tell you, if you're like me, you kind of like it, right? You like when the bad guy, the villain, gets what's coming to him. Anybody else in a movie, when there's somebody like, oh, the guy that like kills a dog in the movie, and you're like, you better get it later, right? And did you know Hollywood actually knows this about us? If you watch a movie, you can know who the villain is within the first few minutes of meeting the villain, because they will always do something to tell you they're a villain. They will do something like they'll drop a cat out of a second story window or something that makes you go, oh, I hope that guy gets it later. Do you know why? Because Hollywood wants, when they kill that guy, they are playing on your need for justice. This is one of the things that modern day Americans, we hide this fact that we all love justice. We all love it when the bad guy gets it. And we're all hoping by the end of the movie, that guy that dropped out, the worst that he is during the movie, or the worst that she is during the movie, the more we're wanting them to get it, right? That's what you're longing. You're like, oh, they're good. And sometimes I'll turn to Jenny during a movie and I'll be like, oh, this guy's gonna die real bad. Like, it's gonna be real bad when he goes out. Cause they're just making you hate him. He killed a dog. That's like the worst thing you could do in America. Listen, this guy, this villain, you look at him and you're like, ah, he's gonna get it. And then Jesus does what Jesus is so good at. He takes this thing that you feel like you're looking at the villain and you're judging what this guy is doing, and then Jesus turns it. And all of a sudden, like this master at playing darts, he throws the dart and it hits a bullseye right in your own heart. And this is what he says, listen. Verse 35, this is how my heavenly Father will treat each of you unless you forgive your brother or sister from your heart. Jesus flips the table on us. Jesus's point. His point is not for you to stand in judgment of this guy, but to realize that you might be the guy. Do you get it? That's his point. He flips everything upside down. He throws the dart. It hits the bullseye in your heart. And all of a sudden you go, oh, I'm not supposed to sit here judging this person. I'm sitting here going, what if that's me? Tell me you haven't held on to some unforgiveness in your own heart. Tell me you haven't been the one who's been forgiven of everything and wants to hold somebody up against the wall and choke them out. See, can I just tell you the context really quick of all of this passage? This passage comes in the context of Jesus being asked a question from Peter. Peter says to Jesus, he says, how many times should I forgive somebody? And Jesus tells him this parable out of that. And before that, the context of Peter asking how many times should I forgive somebody when they sin against me is that Jesus has said, when somebody's sinning in the church, what you need to do is there's a way to address that. You should actually confront people about their sin. So all of this comes in this context of Jesus dealing with people who are sinful and dealing with you looking at other people's sin. And in the middle of it, this is what he says, is that he says that you should forgive the person 70 times 70. Seven times 70. See, the context of all of this, the context of all of this is that in the middle of you and I walking through this life, being offended by other people, being hurt by other people, Jesus looks at us and he says, you've been taken advantage of, I get it, but you've also been forgiven of so very much. It reminds me of a passage in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 1 through 3 that Paul says. Paul says this, he says, as a prisoner of the Lord then, now, have you ever met somebody like your mom? She plays the card like, I remember carrying you around for 9 months. Oh, it was just my sciatic nerve every time I'd sit down. And you're like, okay, mom, what do you want, right? Paul is playing the prisoner of the Lord card right now, right? Listen to him. He says, as a prisoner for the Lord. Like, how do you not listen to a guy who's in jail because he's been preaching for Jesus? As a prisoner for the Lord, then, I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. He's saying to them, as you look back on your life, you have received this calling, you've received this ministry, you've received this grace from Jesus. As you look back on your life and you realize what you've received, I urge you to live a life that's worthy of it. I urge you, as you look back on it, to choose the way that you will interact with every person around you in a way that is worthy of it. This is what he says, verse 2. Be completely humble. Good night. If more of us Christians would just take that one to heart. Be completely humble. Stop thinking that you're something so special. Be patient. And then he says this, listen to this. Bearing with one another in love. That you would bear with one another in love. That you would put up with the discomfort that some of y'all in church are just the weird uncle, alright? Like, it's really just true. There's sometimes just the weird uncle, and you've got to figure out how I'm going to bear with that person in love. I'm going to walk through this. I'm going to live in a place where not everything's perfect, where I don't get everything that I want all the time, where sometimes there's going to be somebody who's wronged me, and I have to sit in church with them and worship Jesus alongside of them. That you would figure out a way to bear with one another in love. Paul and Jesus both are asking us to recall our past so we can redeem our futures. Do you get it? They're saying, remember where you came from. That you were forgiven of so very much. So don't hold other people to a standard that God is never holding you to. Now, can I just put a quick caveat on this? Because there are some of you who have been hurt in ways by people that you should never have been hurt by them. And you misunderstand what forgiveness is because you think forgiveness is forgiving and forgetting, right? You've heard a pastor say, you just need to forgive and forget. And they pull up their pants a little. Now, I'm just telling you right now, that's what you do. You forgive and you forget and it'll be all right. And you're like, I don't know if I can do that. Because what they did to me, I can't ever forget it. I can't get it out of my mind. So can I just wipe that clean? That is not your role to forgive and to forget. It's not your job. Your job is only to forgive. See, forgiving somebody does not mean that you have to excuse their bad behavior. Sometimes what you actually need to do is hold them accountable for their bad behavior. That's an okay thing. What forgiveness is, and trust me, we're going to do a whole series on forgiveness because forgiveness is such a hard thing to really grasp. And I don't think very many Christians really have come to terms with what it means. But I'll give you the quick Kent definition. I think forgiveness is when you give up your right to vengeance. It's when you give up your right to vengeance with somebody else and you trust that God is going to deal with it. That makes sense to you? And so you forgive them by saying to God, I can't hold on to this anymore in my heart. I'm going to trust you and I'm going to treat them like somebody that needs the love of God in their life. And that is not always going to be easy. And I'm telling you the truth right now that it will take years and years of over and over again having to forgive them and having to forgive them and having to forgive them for it to even begin to work in your life. But it will transform your life. Paul and Jesus both invite us to look at where we've came from. And so I'm saying to you, don't walk into this thinking, I have to just forgive and forget, and I have to let what this person... Like, can I just tell you, if somebody has done something bad to a child, you shouldn't put them with children, right? Like, that's not... You understand what they did, and you hold them accountable to it, but there's still a way to forgive them and say, I'm still going to find a way to love you, even though I understand this happened, and I'm never going to let that happen again. Does that make sense to you? I feel like I need to put that caveat on there. And I need to say this, too. Paul says, what do you do with somebody who's caught in a sin? Because some of you may have somebody in your life who's caught in a sin. They're doing stuff that you know is destructive. What do you do with that? Am I just supposed to forgive them, Kent? Yes, but you also need to gently care for them. This is what Paul says in Galatians 6:1. It says, brothers and sisters, if someone is caught in a sin, you who live by the Spirit, so first of all, you better make sure that you're living your life in a way that really pleases Jesus, that you're trying to live your life by the Spirit. Don't go in arrogant. Don't go in thinking you have it all together. If someone is caught in a sin, you who live by the Spirit should restore that person gently. You need to think of the person who's caught in sin like a broken piece of like beautiful pottery that you need to carefully help restore and put back. Not in a way where you just go in and you just berate them and tell them how bad they are and how much you hate their guts and they shouldn't have done X, Y, and Z and you're such a bad person. You go in and you restore gently. But watch yourself, he says, or you may be tempted as well. And as a matter of fact, Jesus in Matthew 18, right before this passage that we're talking about, some of you should go read it because Jesus says if somebody sins against you, you should go and confront them. It's one of the things that drives me nuts in church is when somebody will come and tell me something somebody else did. My first question to you will always be, have you talked to them about it? Because if you haven't, I don't want to hear about it. Because that's what Jesus advocates for. If somebody sins against you, you go and talk to them. And if they don't listen, then you bring somebody with you. And if they still don't listen, listen how hard this is. You bring them before the church. And if they still won't listen to the church, then you treat them like a tax collector or a pagan. And what he means by that is you treat them as somebody who really doesn't know the love of Jesus. And you start the whole discipleship and evangelism process with them again. That's tough. But that's gentle restoration of somebody who's sinful. Listen. Jesus in John 17, and some of you may be going, Kent, why are you even preaching on this? Why do you care about what's happening in my personal life? And it's because of this. Jesus is at the end of his life. He is praying literally before he goes off to die. He's praying with his buddies. They've just eaten the Last Supper, and he's praying, and he's praying, and he's praying. And Jesus prays these words about the unity of the church. Listen to this. John chapter 17, he says, that they may be brought to complete unity. He's praying for you and me, for the people who will hear the word having never seen him. He says that they may be brought to complete unity. Then, listen to this, then the world will know that you sent me. When you and I are in complete unity, that's when the world will know that Jesus was sent to this world to save the world. It is our unity. It's the way we care for each other that says to the world, this group of people is different and called out, and there's something better happening than happens in the rest of the world. When you and I are unified, did you know Jesus prayed for that? When you are causing and stirring up division in a church, you are going against Jesus' prayer for the church. That's it's how Satan, in my mind, works his best in the church. And you know how he does it? He does things like this. I don't like the music they play at that church. That preacher, he just never feeds me. And then you start gossiping about it, and you start talking about it to other people, and you start to cause and create division instead of going to somebody that you believe sinned against you and talking to them like Jesus advocate. You create division. I have no problem with people not liking stuff I do. The problem is when they don't talk to me about the stuff they don't like I do, right? And that, there isn't a big problem with this, but that's why I preach on it, okay? I just want to be clear on that. It's important to hear it so that we know how to deal with those things when they come. Division in the church, it literally is going, it's saying no to Jesus' prayer. It is literally saying, no, Jesus, we don't care about that. The world, he doesn't say the world will know you're my church when you have really great billboards or when you have the best signage or your building really pops from McDonald's parking lot. He doesn't say they'll know that I sent you, that God sent me when their lighting system and their fog is really great, right? That their music is so loud or it's not loud enough. They'll know that we're his by our unity and our love. This is why we're making such a big push for connection groups, why we want everybody to get into one. It's because we know that the best way for the church to fall in love with each other is not in a bad way, but like love each other like Christians love each other. The best way for that to happen is not sitting in rows, it's sitting in circles, face to face. As the church gets bigger, we've got to get smaller and figure out how to do that well. So you have people that are the church that you care about and you love and you want to make a difference in their life and they want to make a difference in your life. And the world looks at us and they say, how do I get some of that? How do I get some of that? But you know what? Until we walk into this whole thing with complete humility and we say, I'm willing to bear with one another. I'm willing to bear with that. One of the things I love the most is when I talk to an older person, because if you're younger, you're used to churches changing all the time. Everything changes all the time. There's some of you who grew up with churches that for like 50 years didn't even change the order of music that they sang. Like, it was like the same songs every Sunday for 50 years. And so you're not used to all this change. And I love it when I hear an older person who says some little piece of this where they say, I really don't like what we're doing, but I love being a part of a church that would try it. Like, it's not for me, but I love that I'm a part of a church that would try to do it to reach other people. I love that because it's this kind of heart that says, I will bear with it. I'll bear with it. I think some of you in here, me included, may need to realize that we need each other and we need to start laying down our right to hold somebody against the wall and offering the forgiveness that we've been given ourselves. If I could, just bear with me. I'd like to tell one story in closing from my own life. I was a young youth pastor, new in ministry, and there was this woman in our church who kind of ran a lot of stuff. It was a larger church. She had her hands on a lot of stuff. My dad called her the pit bull for Jesus. I mean, she just, like, you wanted something done, this woman could get it done. And I somehow very much offended her. I'm pretty sure, looking back on it, that I was very arrogant and very egotistical at the time. And so I don't doubt that I did something wrong, all right? I'm not up here to defend myself. But all I know is, I know that my heart was, I just wanted to do ministry for Jesus. I really wanted to see people come to know Jesus. And so I had done something to offend her. I don't know what it was. But she started kind of coming after me. And I don't mean like she came after me like, hey, Kent, what are you doing? I meant like she tried to get me fired. I never experienced anything like this in a church. It was like just, I couldn't even imagine it. But she started doing things like she called a meeting with all of the parents of our youth group. And she said, I want you guys to I think it'd be good if we all had a chance to ask Kent some questions about his ministry. So what I want you to do is I want you to write your questions out anonymously and then I'll just read them and we'll just go through people's questions. I was a big dummy at the time. I was like, oh, this is a good idea. And so she starts having people pass in these anonymous questions. And the first questions are like, hey, Kent, are we going to do fundraisers for trips? And I'm like, yeah, well, I'm explaining. And then some of the questions are like, how come you never are around this kid's thing? And why aren't you doing this? And why aren't you doing that? And I was like, I try to explain myself. And there'd be another normal question. Then another question that would like totally bring my whole ministry into question. And I was like, I don't, and finally, thank goodness for this guy, Jerome Green, stands up at this meeting. He was a chiropractor. And he was older than me, and he kind of, I think, could see what was going on. And he stood up, and he said, I don't know who's asking these questions, but I'm pretty excited about what Kent's doing for our youth group. How about you guys? And everybody was like, yeah. And he was like, I think we're done with this meeting. And he got up, and everybody got up and left. And I was like, thank you, Jesus, for Jerome Green. Because yeah, you should be one of those people, by the way. Be a Jerome, yeah. I didn't know what to do in the moment. And then she kept going at it, and pretty soon it got to the point where literally she asked for a meeting with the elders and myself, thinking that she could get me fired in this meeting. I'm telling you, I was like this wide-eyed kid at the time, like, I don't know what to do. And I go into this meeting, and she just waylays me in front of all the elders. And I talk, and I'd been praying about it a lot, and I said, God, I just feel like she's a very manipulative woman. And so I just said it. I said, guys, I have tried my best, but I feel like she's very manipulative. And, you know, I said it to her face. It wasn't like gossip. And I said, I want to do my very best, but I don't feel like I can, because I feel like if I don't do what you want, it's not good enough. And she just lit up, and she literally pointed at every elder and said, do you think I'm manipulative? Do you think I'm manipulative? And all the elders were like, uh-huh. And they actually stripped her of her ministry for a time being. And I was left there, and I did ministry, but could I be honest with you? Even though, and I don't think of this as like it went in my favor, because I wasn't thinking of it that way. It wasn't like a me versus her. I was just trying to love Jesus, right? So don't think, like, if you have a problem with me, come and get me. Like, I need to hear about it. But at this point, it was like, I was just trying to do what I thought Jesus wanted me to do. And so I would hear her coming down the hallway. I'd hear her voice. And I'm not proud of this, but I would turn and walk the other way. You ever had somebody like that? And then one day she had built back up. She had ministry again. She was doing things. And it came down to a big, huge event that she had planned. And if she didn't have this one resource that she couldn't get her hands on, the event was going to fail. It wasn't going to work. And she didn't know what to do. And I knew that I was the one person who actually could get my hands on the resource. And I was like, oh man, it is like inside in my heart. I'm just being really honest with you. In my Kentness, that's what I thought. I was like, this is my chance. I can get her. I can hang her out to dry. I wanted to grab her by the throat and slam her against the wall and say, pay me back. But then thank goodness, there's that guy called the Holy Spirit. I said, Ken, I didn't treat you that way. Ken, I forgave you. And I am giving you this opportunity to walk into this woman's life again and offer to humbly serve her. And so this is not because Kent's good, it's because Jesus is so good. I put my pride away. And I invited her into my office, and I'm just being honest with you. There was still a part of me that loved it when she was sitting in my chair squirming, because she knew she didn't have any power in the situation. And there was a part of me that even then I had to die to, and she's sitting there squirming, and I just looked at her and I said, I've heard that if you don't get this resource, your ministry, your event's going to fail, and it's going to be really bad. It's going to be bad for your ministry, bad for the church, bad for the kingdom. And I said, so if you would let me, I would like to give that to you and figure out how to make it happen. And I'm telling you, it was like the air got like returned to the room all of a sudden. She didn't know how to handle it. She thought I was again going to come in with friction. I just had felt very much like Jesus wanted me to serve. And so I served, and I tried to come at the attitude of like somebody who had been forgiven, and can we start new? And I'm telling you, things were totally different after that point. And it is not because I'm good. If I had somebody else's story, if I had been a part of your life and you had one of these moments, I'd have told your story instead of mine. Because the hero in it is Jesus. He's the hero. He's the reason why I did that, because he gave himself for me when I was at my absolute worst, when I owed billions, when I had nothing left to give. He gave himself for me. As a matter of fact, we're going to go and we're going to participate in that, this remembrance of him giving. And so today, as you do that, I want to remind you that Jesus' call to bear with one another, it is for us to love past what's comfortable, and that it still applies today. This is not, if you've learned one thing about me, it's that I don't take these things that Jesus says as some high platitude that we should all come and give a little, like, oh, Really, that really moved me. And then walk away from it. I really legitimately try to live these things out. Ask our staff, ask my wife, ask my children, if I really am trying to live this out, because I don't want to be a fake phony who gets up on stage and then is something totally different. I want it to be real because it still applies. It still matters today.